Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Misery in Gaza. With international pressure mounting on Israel to completely lift its blockade of Gaza following the recent sea raid, we shine the spotlight on the plight of ordinary Gazans, where most of the population is dependent on UN or charity handouts to get by. The Doubting Apostle. As the Church marks today's feast day of St. Thomas the Apostle, we find out more about a relic here in Rome from this disciple, who is best known for his initial difficulty in believing in the reality of Jesus' resurrection. And Vatican Centuries, episode 43. Hear how the Roman question was finally resolved and how Vatican Radio first came into being in today's episode, covering the period following the end of the First World War. What are living conditions really like in the territory of Gaza, ruled by the Islamic group Hamas, that has been under a crippling Israeli blockade for the past 3 years? Israel recently announced plans to ease its embargo on Gaza, to let in all goods except for arms and materials that could be used for military purposes, such as cement and steel. The Jewish state has come under strong pressure to soften its policy towards Gaza, following an international outcry after its commandos killed 9 pro-Palestinian activists last month during a sea raid on a convoy of ships carrying aid for Gaza. President Obama recently described the situation in Gaza as unsustainable. So is that an accurate description of what conditions are like in this coastal strip that is home to 1.5 million Palestinians? To find out more about the plight of ordinary Gazans, I spoke to Justin Kilcullen, director of the Irish Catholic humanitarian agency Trocara, who has just returned from a visit to Gaza. He said he found an oppressed population with growing poverty and malnutrition levels among the children.
Well, I think it's very serious, really. When I was there, I met with senior UN officials who gave us figures. And while figures can be boring, they do tell a tale about growing malnutrition amongst children, for instance, about 700,000 people dependent on food aid, living on less than €2 a day. These are statistics of poverty and abject poverty. And that is the situation for more than half of the population of the Gaza Strip. Sometimes people have remarked upon the shops in Gaza City that are full of consumer goods and that the markets have fruit and vegetables in them and so on. And they use this as an example of how things are not so bad in Gaza. But, you know, there is always a percentage of a population, no matter how bad things are, that have been successful in the past, that have acquired wealth and who know how to manage it. And there is a small consumer kind of society there. But for the vast majority of people, this is very much a third world country, and it's getting poorer rather than getting better. And that's why I believe that this embargo must be lifted completely, because a loosening of the conditions and allowing more goods in simply creates continued aid dependency. And what Gaza needs is not more aid, but it needs that its society can begin to get back to normal. That people can have employment, that there can be commercial life, economic life, and people can begin to look forward to a future for themselves and their children.
What for you were some of the most distressing or visible consequences of the blockade on everyday life in the Gaza Strip?
Well, I think people's housing was quite shocking, really, to think that 18 months ago, in one particular village we visited, the Israeli Defense Forces had come over the border just over a kilometer away and had come through and had destroyed so many of the houses in the village. And people are still living there now, having taken what's left of their house that's standing and draped plastic sheeting and canvas and metal sheeting around it to create a temporary shelter. And there they sit, 15 people in one particular household that we visited, and they just don't have the materials available in the market to repair their housing. And, you know, these were people who were not necessarily poor when this happened. I mean, some of the houses seem to be quite fine houses, I mean, two-story houses. But these families have been impoverished by what has happened, and they have, you know, lost employment, lost their livelihoods, and lost their homes. And this, to me, is part of the tragedy, because we talk about the need for a peaceful solution, and Israel talks about Gaza being an enemy territory. But when you see what the population has been subjected to, and, if you like, the middle class, impoverished, and young men, 12, 13, 14-year-old boys, subjected to this and having seen what has happened, of course they are attracted to the idea of revenge. The idea of Hamas is attractive to young people like that who are angry about what has happened to them. So I believe that what is happening is, in fact, making Israel's security worse rather than better. And I don't understand the logic of what's going on at all.
You talk there about the anger of people, and when you actually talk to some of these you came into contact with during your visit, I mean, how would you describe their overall mood, and what were they actually saying about life and everything?
Well, the word that was being repeated in many different conversations was misery. And that is really what it is. I mean, they have been reduced to a state of misery in that, you know, they have no control over their own lives. If they become dependent on food aid, dependent on other forms of aid, have no employment, no proper housing, inadequate education for their children, and no way in which parents can in any way console their children by offering them a future or what have you. So I would say that it's a society that's both oppressed and depressed. And for me, again, I think that politically this is a very dangerous situation to allow to develop, because the only way you can keep the lid on this is through further oppression. So I was saddened, actually, by people I met. And, you know, a fisherman that I spoke to, we went to a fishing community. There's a population of about 8,000 who are dependent on the fishing industry in the south of the Strip. And that industry is now gone. They're not allowed to fish outside the three-mile limit. The fishing stocks have been exhausted. And the seas have become so polluted, I mean, 20 million litres of raw sewage are pumped into the sea every day, that people, frankly, don't have an appetite for fish anymore. And so these people have been made redundant. And one man told me about his son, who is in jail in Israel, who completed his five-year sentence, was due to be released, and then was retained or remanded further on an indefinite detention order. And he's kind of saying, well, when am I going to see my son again? And so you have this kind of thing piled one on top of the other. You know, it is just unacceptable, really. This is the collective punishment of 1.5 million people who find themselves living under a political government that is extreme, that has found its way into this position because of the political circumstances that prevail in the region. And I don't believe that populations as a whole should be punished because of the political system they find themselves under. But this is what is happening.
Kilcullen went on to speak about the role of the small Catholic church community in Gaza and how they are trying to ease the hardship of the poor and vulnerable.
I think that the population there, the people we meet, welcomed the visit, welcomed being able to tell their story, knew that we would tell this story on their behalf when we went home, and it gives them a little bit of hope. And we went to the parish there, the Holy Family Parish in Gaza City, and there were two priests and 8 or 9 nuns and a lot of lay people involved, working with children, with orphans, with the handicapped. And they're saying that life is very difficult. In fact, Father Elias, when we were leaving, he said, this is not a normal situation. It's difficult to live here, especially for the children.
Did you sort of see any signs that the children were perhaps, you know, thinner than they should be? They weren't getting sufficient rations, as you said. You know, 80% of the population are relying on handouts to survive.
Well, I mean, what we saw were kids playing in the streets, certainly, and what I'd have to say, the image was of ragged children, and we saw them going through dumps and trying to find stuff to salvage and to sell. I mean, these are symptoms of severe poverty when you see that kind of thing going on. For the children, it is certainly difficult. And we heard from the United Nations about the school situation where they're now working three shifts a day in some schools to try and get all the kids in at least for 3 or 4 hours a day. And with the lack of building materials, they're now turning containers into school rooms. So you can imagine what that's like in 35 degrees heat, having 20, 30 children in a metal container trying to teach them. I mean, these are the extraordinary levels to which people have to go now to try and maintain some semblance of normality in their life. I mean, you certainly get the sense when you go into Gaza that you have arrived in a prison. It has been described as an open-air prison. That could be seen to be a metaphor.
Why do you think this blockade has carried on for so long? As everybody has seen, Hamas has stuck to its militant positions concerning Israel. And of course, the US and the EU continue to refuse to recognize Hamas because of these militant positions. So are we really stuck into a standoff without any way out?
Well, I think that the EU in particular made a mistake when Hamas won the elections in saying we will not have anything to do with Hamas until they renounce their intention, until they recognize Israel, in effect, because they boxed themselves into a corner out of which they cannot now get. And I think that has been a major stumbling block. And EU diplomats will off the record tell you that they see it that way themselves. We know in the Irish situation, Northern Ireland, in the peace process here, the IRA did not recognise the United Kingdom's right to govern in Northern Ireland. Indeed, neither did the Constitution of the Republic of Ireland. It wasn't until the very end, when the deal was done, that both sides said, right now, we will recognise Northern Ireland as part of the United Kingdom. Now, asking Hamas, however militant and unsavoury a bunch they are, to sign away one of their main positions as a precondition is a way of ensuring talks will never get going. So what needs to happen is to look at what other successful peace processes have done to achieve success and learn from them. And the Irish process would certainly indicate that you need to be open, don't have too many preconditions, get people into a process, engage as many as possible, and eventually you will work towards a solution. And until they break that logjam, it's hard to see how they're going to get this result.
Would you agree with those critics who say that those who are suffering most in Gaza at the moment are the ordinary people rather than the Hamas-controlled government who, as people have pointed out, gets funds, a lot of funds from Iran and other sources and from smuggling, of course?
Yes, well, I mean, as is always the case, it's the ordinary people who suffer. I mean, and most ordinary people, no matter where they are in the world, their first priority is to get on with their life, to look after their family and hope for a better future for their children than they've had themselves. In fact, one of the ironies of this whole blockade, and it shows that there's maybe more behind it than what appears on the surface, is that the 1,000 tunnels that go from through Rafah to Egypt make a nonsense, in a sense, of the blockade, because there's so many goods coming through the tunnels, and the Hamas government tax that economy, the tunnel economy, and it gives them a source of income. And that, of course, gives them even increased power, because they're one of the few groups in the entire territory that actually has a source of income, and they are in control. So this is why sometimes what appears on the surface seems so ridiculous. You think, well, what is actually going on underneath here? You know, what is the subplot that's going on politically? And it's difficult for us. We are a humanitarian, Catholic development agency. Our job is not to get engaged in the murkiness of the politics of the region. We take principled positions on human rights, and because that is right, because there's the abuse of human rights that's creating this poverty. But it really is for politicians to sort this out. And we would see that particularly European politicians are not taking the necessary steps that are required for whatever historical reasons that certain of our European partners feel, whatever it is. I'm afraid Israel is allowed to act with impunity, and it really does need to be challenged and made to respect international law and human rights law.
Reports from Gaza say 3 out of 4 factories there have closed because they can't import or export as a result of the blockade. And Kilcullen says this lack of any proper commercial activity is breeding still more resentment against Israel.
What is most obvious is the destruction. just when we went to see some of the former industrial areas, they're just like bomb sites, which is exactly what they are. And the biggest industry that I saw going on there was recycling, because everything is being taken away and broken up. Even the concrete is being broken up to make it into hardcore for road construction or whatever, bits of steel. Everything is being taken away and being worked upon and is being used elsewhere. And I suppose you'd have to hand it to the ingenuity of those who can find a use for everything. I think what you feel there is kind of a lack of energy and action in society. There's, you know, not much happening. Yeah, people just kind of, you know, taking it easy, but not in any way relaxed.
Can you share with us any anecdote concerning a Gazan or Gazan family that you met whose plight was particularly memorable or poignant for you?
Well, there was certainly a woman that we met, and her husband and two of her children were shot by Israeli troops, in her view. And she's now living in, I suppose it would be a warehouse. She has a kind of a walled-off corner of a warehouse, and she's there with her five remaining children. And we went to see her, and she had photographs of her dead husband and children, one of whom was a four-year-old boy, and there were four clear bullet wounds on his body, one of which was in his head. And she produces these photographs and showed them to us. I mean, they're well-thumbed photographs. She became emotional, as you could imagine, when she was doing this. The other children were running around. It was very hot and sweltering in this warehouse with a metal roof. And as we were coming out, she just pointed to her seven-year-old girl who came over, a very pretty little girl, and she just said something which was translated for us. And then it was, and we thought we had lost her as well, because she was 3 days in the rubble, but we found her again. And all that happened just 18 months ago. So that's quite shocking, really, when you encounter that level of poverty and of misery. And, you know, her struggle to rear her family now, her remaining five kids, on her own, and with very little means to do so.
Okay, finally, how do you see Gaza's future if the blockade is not fully lifted soon?
Well, I think unless proper commercial and economic life is restored in Gaza, then it will remain something of a political pressure cooker, because resentment against this collective punishment can only grow, and the only way that can be contained is by the Israeli forces causing even more repression. And so unless the blockade is lifted completely and people are allowed to travel to visit their relatives in the West Bank, in Jordan and beyond, that students who have scholarships to study abroad are free to go and come back, unless that kind of normality is restored, then the future of Gaza looks bleak, and it makes the political problem even more difficult to resolve.
I was speaking to Justin Kilcullen, director of the Irish Catholic aid agency Trocora, about life in Gaza. Today, July the 3rd, is the feast day of St. Thomas the Apostle, who is best known for his initial scepticism about the reality of Jesus' resurrection from the dead. One of the 12 men called to be Christ's disciples, Thomas is believed to be the twin brother of Matthew, although some sources say he was the twin of James. Thomas's unwillingness to believe that the other apostles had seen the risen Lord on the first Easter Sunday merited for him the title of Doubting Thomas. 8 days later, on Christ's second apparition, Thomas was gently rebuked for his scepticism and invited by Jesus to touch with his fingers the crucifixion wounds in his side, whereupon the apostle's doubts ended and he publicly professed his faith in the divinity of Jesus. Liz Lev is a teacher of Christian art and archaeology at Duquesne University's Rome campus and is also an expert on relics. She told me why she especially likes the relic of St. Thomas's finger that can be found in Rome's Church of the Holy Cross in Jerusalem, a basilica that also contains a collection of other relics relating to Christ's passion and crucifixion.
My favorite relic in Rome is in the Church of the Holy Cross of Jerusalem, built by St. Helena in the 4th century AD. It's right there with all the other objects of the Passion, the true cross, the nails, the thorns. It's the finger of St. Thomas. the finger that a doubting Thomas insisted that he would not believe in the resurrection of Christ until he put that finger in Christ's side and felt his wounds with it. And I think that relic is a very good way of understanding our relationship to relics in the church, in that Thomas, like a normal human being, wants to use his senses to understand. He wants to see, he wants to touch, he wants to feel, he wants to know empirically. And Jesus understands it without even Thomas even having to ask him. Jesus approaches him and tells him to feel with his own hands the wounds. Christ understands our doubts and our uncertainties. But at the same time, as Thomas verifies with his own eyes and says, "My Lord and my Savior," Jesus reminds him, "You have seen and you have believed, Thomas, but blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe." And I find that a very good way to go through the question of relics.
I was speaking there to Liz Lev, an expert on Christian art and archaeology in Rome. We now broadcast the 43rd episode in our ongoing historical series, where we look at the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican. Today's episode is called A Brave New World and looks at the period following the end of the First World War, when the so-called Roman question was finally resolved and Vatican Radio first came into being. The series is written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett.
The year is 1918. Out of the chaos of a war that had involved half the civilized world, the nations were slowly emerging. The old continent of Europe, her physiognomy changed beyond recognition, her peoples dismembered, sought desperately to rise from the debris and build a new world from the ashes of the old.
Everywhere the troops were returning home, lean, ragged, but still young men, with disenchantment in their eyes. Never again would people believe in the glory of war. The sordid reality of the trenches and gas warfare had been revealed in all its starkness by the letters and dispatches from the front, by the poems of men like Wilfred Owen and Siegfried Sassoon, by novels like All Quiet on the Western Front by Erich Maria Remarque.
An indication of changing times had been the participation of the New World in the events of Europe. Not only a common language and a common culture, but a sense of the brotherhood of man. "The world must be made safe for democracy," was the slogan with which the United States entered the war in 1917.
Rapidity of communications meant that news of the Great War had penetrated even the innermost depths of the African continent, as Dr. Albert Schweitzer, the German humanitarian, recorded in his diary.
Important events not directly connected with the war occurred during those sober years. The opening of the Panama Canal, the Irish Easter Rising of 1916, and a year later, the Russian Revolution.
In the years following the war, people lived life at fever pitch. The bright young things of the roaring 20s danced to the frenetic rhythm of the Charleston, a generation determined to live for the present because it was uncertain that there would be a future.
The spirit of the age was reflected in its music and art. The music of George Gershwin, of Ravel, Stravinsky, Prokofiev, the art of Braque and Picasso. Marcel Proust was writing in stream of consciousness.
Post-war reconstruction was slow. A climate of unemployment and inflation aided the rise of fascism. By 1925, Mussolini had declared himself dictator. 2 years earlier, a man named Adolf Hitler had founded the National Socialist Party in Germany. And from far-off China came news of a split between nationalist and communist leaders. The world was shrinking fast.
Everywhere, it seemed, things were falling apart. Nothing again would ever be quite the same. The old, easy pace of gracious living had been swept away in the flood. A whole social structure was crumbling.
While in Rome, the cardinals were choosing a successor to Benedict XV, Pope of the First World War, and the first pope to be publicly mourned by the secular state.
The new pope came from the middle classes, son of a silk industrialist. Pius XI was the first pope to issue a full-scale, unconditional condemnation of communism in his encyclical Divini Redemptoris of March 19, 1937.
The pontificate of Pius XI was marked by two significant happenings, the signing of the Lateran Pacts and the inauguration of Vatican Radio.
On February the 11th, 1929, the Vatican, so-called as a place, ceased to exist. It became instead Vatican City, an independent state subject to international law and with all the rights and privileges thereto pertaining. The Pope was the sovereign of the new Vatican City State, which covered a territory of about 109 acres, with extraterritorial rights over certain buildings in Rome and over Castel Gandolfo.
Thus, a peaceful solution to the thorny Roman question had finally been found.
To commemorate the conciliation between church and state, Benito Mussolini gave orders for the old Borgo, the street leading from Castel Sant'Angelo to St. Peter's, to be demolished. In its place, a wide avenue was built, today's Via della Conciliazione. Among the houses which were destroyed in the process was that containing Raphael's studio.
The Vatican celebrated the signing of the Lateran Pacts in the traditional way, with a pontifical high mass. H.V. Morton, in his book A Traveller in Rome, records the event.
The Pope was borne into the church in the state palanquin, while trumpets sounded, peacock fans waved, and the packed church shouted its head off in welcome. For the first time in 48 years, Rome was seeing a Pope who was no longer the prisoner of the Vatican. Within a few yards of the altar, at which no priest save the Pope may officiate, I watched the intricacies of pontifical high mass. Hardly less interesting than the Pope himself was the figure of a prelate in a red soutane and a lace rochet, the master of ceremonies, who pulled a cardinal into place here and waved another there with a hasty wave of his hand. He was like the spirit of orthodoxy, a living and visible proof of the complexity of tradition. And the princes of the church obeyed him as if they were erring choir boys.
Pius XI was nothing if not a promoter of science and progress. In 1929, within 4 days of the signing of the Lateran Pacts, he sent for the inventor of the wireless, Guglielmo Marconi, and asked him to build a radio station inside the Vatican.
It was on a fine spring morning of the year 1895 that 21-year-old Guglielmo Marconi conducted the last of a series of experiments in what was soon to be called wireless telegraphy, known today as sound radio.
The initial skepticism which greeted the invention quickly disappeared as the world began to realize its usefulness to society.
Ships were fitted out with radio apparatus, and the signals sent by radio officers saved many lives.
In 1909, Marconi was awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics. Universities all over the world gave him honorary degrees. In 1929, the King of Italy made him a Marquis.
But Marconi's head was not turned by all the honors. He continued to work at his invention, perfecting it and seeking new ways of applying it. When he died in July 1937, he was still at work.
February the 12th, 1931, the inauguration of the Vatican radio station. Marconi's voice preceded that of Pope Pius XI.
Inaugurerà la stazione radio dello Stato della Città del Vaticano.
Io arcano dei consiglio succedimus in loco principis apostolorum e orum lempe, quorum doctrina et predicatio, justo divino, ad omne gente et ad omnem creatura.
The series was written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. Well, that's all for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.